So before there was Rush Limbaugh or Don Imus or Howard Stern or Tucker Carlson, there was a guy named Paul Harvey. So born and raised right over in Tulsa, I don't know if you knew that, Paul Harvey grew up in Tulsa. He had a voice like velvet, and he secured his first radio gig there over in Tulsa at just 14 years old. And by the 1950s, ABC had launched him on a sort of nationally syndicated program, and Paul Harvey quickly became a household name. And probably his most famous program was something called The Rest of the Story. How many of you remember The Rest of the Story? Oh, good, a lot of hands. Great. I'm not going to take a poll of how old you all are, right? But glad that a number of you know it. I was introduced to that program as a kid when I would take my semi-annual visit out to see my father, and he'd pick me up at the airport, and I always remember we'd jump in the car, and it seemed that program was always on the radio. And that program ran until Paul Harvey's death in 2009. And the show was famous because part of what it would do is it would take either a character or an event that was very familiar to all of us. Well, it takes such a character event. Maybe it was the assassination of JFK, or maybe it was something about the Revolutionary War. And he'd take something that you thought you knew well, and then he'd introduce you to some forgotten facts. He'd introduce you to some little-known details. He'd fill out the narrative, and in doing so, provide a kind of new angle and a new insight. And he'd really open up a whole new world, such that by the end of the show, and the shows were only like 4 or 5 minutes long, but by the end of it, you'd never think of that person or that event in the same way again. And his program always ended the same. And now you know the rest of the story. There it is. Okay, all right, you weren't lying to me when you raised your hands. You know it. Well, I was thinking of Paul Harvey this week because I think in many ways the gospel writer John is doing exactly the same thing with our text this morning. In many ways, I think the gospel writer is the original Paul Harvey, because he's going to take two of the perhaps most familiar events in the life of Jesus, when he feeds the 5,000 and then when he walks on water, miracles that many of us learned when we were very young, miracles we know well. And what does John do? He digs a bit deeper. He highlights some forgotten facts. He points out some tiny details. He draws our attention to often neglected characters. And in doing so, he alters the portrait that many of us have of Jesus. John's challenging our assumptions about Jesus. He's confronting our own expectations of Jesus so that we would know the rest of the story. So friend, how well do you know Jesus this morning? Well, let's find out together, all right? Let's find out together. I want to invite you, if you haven't already, turn to the Gospel of John with me. We're going to be in chapter 6, verses 1 through 21 this morning. And if you don't have a Bible with you, we provide those red Bibles in the seat back before you. You can find it on page 891, I believe, page 891. And we've noted that the Gospel of John is about belief, namely, that believing Jesus is the Christ brings eternal life. And yet one of the greatest surprises so far in John's gospel is that the characters that we expect to believe, like really righteous people like Nicodemus or the religious elite, well, they don't believe. And the people that we least expect to believe, like a scandalous Samaritan woman or a Gentile royal official, well, they in fact do believe. So Jesus seems to have this uncanny ability to make sworn enemies out of people who should be friends, and to make friends out of people who ought to be sworn enemies. And it all comes down to what you believe about Jesus. And we left 2 weeks ago at the end there of chapter 5, where Jesus is just infuriated, right, the Jewish officials, by claiming that all of the Old Testament scriptures are about him. They point to him. And in chapter 6, he proves it. He proves those scriptures are about him. So let's read chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. Follow along. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand, and lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "Well, there is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, and so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." And so they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. And when the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." And perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. And when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing, and when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." And then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. So we've just come really to one of the most important chapters in John's gospel. And again, 2 of the most famous miracles in all the Bible. In fact, the feeding of the 5,000 is the only miracle other than the resurrection. It's the only miracle recorded in all 4 gospels. And yet, some natural questions should arise, because we're told in the final verse of John's gospel, right, 21:25, well, that's we're reminded that there were many other things Jesus did that are not recorded in the gospel, things of which we know nothing about. So why record these 2 events? Why put them together, and why are they placed right here in the story? Friends, those are always good questions to ask when you read your Bible, because these may seem like somewhat random events stitched together, maybe only by happenstance. But friends, the Bible never does anything randomly. And the Bible always rewards careful study. So what do these 2 miracles teach us about Jesus? Well, I think they teach us simply that Jesus is the deliverer we need, because Jesus is divine. I mean, that's basic argument of chapter 6, 1 through 21. Jesus is the deliverer we need because Jesus is divine. And if you're wondering exactly how we got there this morning, I pray that as we work through it, it will become clear. And that summary sentence will just serve as the basis for our outline. First, Jesus is the deliverer we need. And then second, Jesus is divine. Nice and simple. And the bulk of the message, I'll just let you know, the bulk of the message is around point 1, because we cover most of the verses there. So lest you fear that you're going to miss lunch, which would be rather ironic given the text, right? Lest you fear you're going to miss lunch, don't worry if we're well into the sermon before we get to point 2. Okay. So first, Jesus is the deliverer we need. Jesus is the deliverer we need. So every people, every nation, they have their deliverer. The one who has ushered in freedom and peace and prosperity and the like. And in the U.S., of course, that figure is George Washington. It was he who led the Continental Army to victory over those repugnant redcoats. I'm looking at Christian. Christian would happily tell you all about that July 4th holiday. What he playfully refers to as Happy Treason Day, right? That's what he calls it. Christians are, he's our elder from England, if you don't know. Okay. But getting back, it was Washington who presided as the first president over the fledgling nation. It was Washington who then willingly gave up power and presided over a peaceful transfer of power, so uncommon at the time, helping to ensure this new republic survived. And it was then Washington who went back to his estate, farmed, and lived out his life. And he's revered in every way. And so after all, we reside, and we're right now in what county? We're in Washington County, that's right. And of course, we came here, my wife and I, from Washington, D.C. And of course, there are universities, tons of universities with Washington's name. There's George Washington University. There is Washington and Lee. There is Washington University St. Louis. There are states named after Washington. There's Mount Washington. There's Fort Washington. You get the point. For the Jews, though, that figure was Moses. Moses was the one who had led them out of slavery in Egypt. Moses was the one who had led them through the Red Sea. Moses was the one who had established Israel as a nation. Moses was the one that mediated the Ten Commandments to God's people, brought them the law. Moses oversaw the building of the tabernacle where God would dwell with his people. Moses was not just a military hero and a political hero. He was their great spiritual hero. It'd be kind of like taking George Washington and like Billy Graham and Chief Justice John Marshall and like wrapping them up in one person. Like that's how big Moses was to the Jewish people. No one was greater. And that reverence and respect for Moses is the kind of background. It's the backdrop for chapter 6. Because remember how chapter 5 ended. Jesus claiming, verse 46, if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. And so chapter 6 becomes a kind of dramatization of chapter 5, verse 46. Chapter 6 is a kind of living reenactment because echoes of Moses and the Exodus are everywhere in those verses I just read. I wonder if you caught any of them. Right, this is a little like Where's Waldo, but hopefully, you know, you're not just guessing in the dark. So consider, just as Moses led a large crowd, so here, what are we told twice that Jesus is leading a large crowd? Verse 2 and verse 5. Just as what did Moses do? He performed signs in Egypt. Well, what is Jesus doing here? Twice we're told he performs signs. Verse 2 and verse 14. Just as Moses ascended a mountain to instruct God's people, so here we read verse 3 that Jesus himself ascends a mountain. Just as Exodus was commemorated with the Passover, so here, what are we told? Verse 4, it's Passover time. Just as the people under Moses undergo testing in the wilderness, right? Exodus 15, Deuteronomy 8, so we're explicitly told, and it's the same word, that Philip and Andrew, but principally Philip was tested. Verse 6, just as the people enjoyed manna under Moses, so what? They enjoy bread from heaven under Jesus. Verse 11, and just as Moses twice led the people through water, right? The Red Sea, and then later the Jordan River into the Promised Land. Just as Moses led them through water as if on dry ground, so what? Jesus walks on water as if it's dry ground. Verse 19. So in every way, these two stories together, well, for those with eyes to see, these two miracles serve as visible proof that Jesus is the new and better Moses who's come to deliver his people. He is the new leader. He's the one ushering in a new rescue in the form of a new Exodus to create what? A new people under God. John is saying in every way that Jesus is the deliverer we need. He's not just an earthly king, but a heavenly one. He's not just leading an earthly rescue, but a heavenly one. He's not just offering earthly bread, but as we're going to even see more next week, he's going to offer us living bread, heavenly bread, that we might never hunger again. He's not only fulfilling all the promises of Scripture, he's elevating those promises to a whole new level. And in what way is Jesus the deliverer we need? Well, he shows us. He shows us how he alone satisfies our hunger. He shows us how he alone silences our fears. And he shows us how he alone saves from sin. So let's think about some of those things together for a moment. First, he does show us he is our deliverer we need, because he alone satisfies our hunger. He alone satisfies our hunger. Of course, the scene opens with Jesus and his disciples, and they're crossing over the sea of Galilee to the eastern side, and because John has Gentile readers, you notice he lists the sea by its more common Gentile name, the Sea of Tiberias, of course, because it was named after Tiberius Caesar. There was a large crowd, then we read, following him, verse 2. And why was there a large crowd following Jesus? Well, because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus is like a walking Mayo Clinic. Right, the best healthcare provider anyone's ever seen. And best news, it was free. Right? No doctor bills, no hospital bills. No wonder the people love Jesus. No wonder they're following him. And there on the mountain, which in this place on the eastern side, this would be the Golan Heights, he sees, Jesus does, the crowd coming toward him. And notice he asks a rather peculiar question of Philip, verse 5. He asks Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? Now, I don't know about you, but the last time I was at an event with a large crowd, right? Maybe it was a concert, maybe it was a sporting event. I didn't feel personally compelled to feed everyone. I don't know about you, maybe you're kinder than me, but I didn't, my own kids maybe, right? But no, I didn't feel compelled to feed everyone. At one level, this isn't Jesus's problem, right? Jesus didn't invite the crowds, right? They've come to him. But we read that he asked this of Philip, verse 6, to test him. For he, Jesus, knew himself what he would do. Right? It was a test. Again, the same word used of Israel when they were tested in the wilderness. Friends, sometimes God will try and test us. Sometimes Jesus will put us in difficult situations in order to test and reveal the quality or lack thereof of our own faith. He'll sometimes push us to the limits of what we think we can handle, what we think we can understand, what we think we can endure in order that we might learn to trust him more. Because the temptation is always to do what? It's to just revert back to ourselves, to go back and to think about us, isn't it? The temptation, I know for me, it's always to trust in myself or to depend upon myself or to rely on myself or look to myself or lean on myself. I think we all have that instinct. It's not natural for us to look to God, to lean on God, to depend upon God, to rely upon God. That must be taught. That must be learned often, sadly, again and again. It's a lesson we need. And this is the lesson that Philip had to learn. Because notice how Philip responds to Jesus' question. 200 denarii worth of bread. Well, all that would not be enough for each of them to get a little. I like how the NIV captures it. It would take more than half a year's wages, about 8 months' wages, to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite. You see, Philip's already doing the math. Right? Philip's the kind of guy who approaches everything pragmatically. He's the one who sees life through the spectacles, right, of numbers and statistics, very practical, lives life with a calculator and a spreadsheet, right? That's Philip. Every business division, every family, every church has Philips in them. And after doing some quick arithmetic, Philip concludes, this is impossible. None of them are walking around with like 40 grand in cash, or they could just go get food. Well, same with Andrew in verse 9. Now, he does note the boy's lunch. And those little barley loaves, just so you know, those are better translated probably cakes. So they're like biscuit size. They're very small. So don't think big loaves of bread here. And that word for fish suggests tiny fish. It's one of the details John gives us. So it's more like sardines or like pickled herring or something. It's almost like a spread that you would put on the cake. Right? This was a lunch for a little boy. Not a lot of food. And so Andrew sees it, he shrugs his shoulders, he sighs and says, right, but what is this? What is this little lunch for this little boy? What is it for so many? And friends, both of them flunk the test, don't they? For Jesus asked them where to buy bread. And Philip is from this region. Philip knows there is no place to go and buy bread for a group this large. And friends, that's Jesus' point. Jesus was driving Philip to that place where you would recognize there is nowhere to turn, where they can get bread. And that's what Jesus often does, isn't it? Jesus often brings us to the end of ourselves. He leads us to what appears to be a dead end, where all human options have been exhausted. And it's then that Jesus shows the way. And sadly, it never seems to occur to Philip or to Andrew or any other disciple that the where of this bread is the one staring them straight in the face. Had they forgotten the very first sign? What was Jesus' first sign just before a Passover? It was to turn water into wine. He has done this before. Could he not do it again? Right, they've got their own stone mill bread co, right? He's right in front of them. This guy can just produce bread all he wants. They don't see it. They don't see it. And it's easy to point the finger at Philip and Andrew, isn't it? But friends, we got to ask, are we really any different? How many times do we need to see God lead us through what appears to be an impossible situation before we ourselves stop doubting and start believing? When confronted with divine problems, how many times do we grasp for human solutions like Philip? And if we don't see any, how often do we just throw our hands up in despair like Andrew? Right? There's no way, it's no use, it's impossible. Now, the beautiful thing is that we can flunk the test and Jesus doesn't kick us out of class. That's the wonderful thing. When you follow Jesus, regardless of how it looks, when you follow Jesus, you never reach a dead end. When you follow Jesus, you do. You just never reach a dead end. Jesus is going to say, listen, I know you flunked the test. Just put your pencil down. Why don't you listen, watch, and pull out some silverware while you're at it, because we're about to enjoy a feast. Now, some of you will remember that old TV show, MacGyver. Okay, I'm reaching back. These are not modern-day illustrations here. MacGyver was a guy who regularly found himself in what? In impossible situations. Situations where there was seemingly no escape. And then what would he do? Well, he's in this impossible moment where it looks like everything's about to implode, everyone's going to die, and he like reaches into his pocket and he grabs a stick of gum, and then he like takes off a shoe and pulls out an old sweaty sock, and then he grabs like glasses or something, and he puts it all together and he blows a hole through concrete. Right? Something crazy. Point being, when all appeared hopeless, MacGyver always found a way. And he never killed anybody, which is great. Friends, that's how it is with Jesus. In that sense, he's kind of a spiritual MacGyver. However impossible the situation, there's never a dead end with Jesus. He always finds a way. Because when Jesus supplies for his people, it's never too little. He never runs out. He's never shrugging his shoulders in helplessness. He never runs into a problem he can't solve. No wine at a wedding? That's no problem. No feet for 40 years? Not a problem. No food in the wilderness? Not a problem. No life? Not a problem for Jesus. When you follow Jesus, you never reach a dead end. And that's the lesson that they and we so often need to be reminded of. And so Jesus does what? He has everyone sit. And John notes something in verse 10. He notes the grass. Now, I mean, who really honestly cares about the grass of something that happened over 2,000 years ago? But of course, if it's Passover, that means it's the spring, and that means the grass would be lush and it would be green, right? It's not summer, so the summer sun hasn't burned those hills brown yet. You got lush green grass. And if John was there, you know what? That would be a detail he'd probably remember. He'd remember what it was like to plop down on that lush green grass, to feel that cool ground under his worn hands and tired feet. So if you've come this morning and you're maybe a skeptic to the Bible, I totally get that. When I first came to the Bible, I was a skeptic. I would read these stories and I'm like, no way. This stuff didn't happen. A bunch of people just made it up, right? Trying to form a religion. But I have to say, this is one of those little moments, a small little detail that only an eyewitness would recall. It's one of those details, just commenting on the grass, that you would never mention if you're just making up a story 30 years later. It speaks, I think, to the authenticity of the story. And this is what you regularly find with the Gospels. I mean, one of the clearest is the fact is that none of the heroes are really heroes. They're all a bunch of guys who make mistakes and they blow it. Not the kind of people you'd build a religion around. But again, John was there. And I think John can record facts like that because he remembers this day when Jesus performed this great miracle. He remembers it like it was yesterday. And we're told that those who sat were 5,000 men. So you include women and children, and you're talking upwards of 15, maybe 20,000 people. I mean, this is a massive number that just sat down on the grass. Ben Evans and I were joking. We often can't get our own kids to sit at the table, and Jesus got 20,000 people to sit down, no problem. Well, Jesus takes the boys' lunch. He offers a kind of blessing. Notice he's blessing God. He's not blessing the food. He's blessing God that provided it. And then what does he do? He just distributes the bread and the fish. Verse 11, as much as they wanted. An endless supply of food, right? A true all-you-can-eat buffet. You know, my wife and I love to go to Meiji. We love sushi. I mean, this is my dream. Like, I eat the sushi, I turn around, I come back, and whoa, there's more fish. Right? How awesome. They have everything they need. How does Jesus do it? We're not told. Right? It's a miracle. And that's the point. And there's so much left over that they gather it into 12 baskets so that we read verse, where is that? 12 baskets. Oh yeah, verse 12. So that nothing may be lost. Now this was one of those Bible stories, the feeding of the 5,000. It's one of the only Bible stories I ever heard in my Unitarian church growing up. I wasn't there a lot. That was part of it. They also just didn't talk a whole lot about the Bible. But I do remember they did talk about this story. And I remember the moral of the story, this feeding of the 5,000. And the moral was this: be like this magnanimous boy. This boy who, what did he do? He shared his lunch. And this young boy who shared his lunch so inspired everyone else that they too looked down and, well, they pulled out their lunches and they shared their lunches too. And everyone ate. And, lest you be concerned, don't let any go to waste. Right? Gather all that's left because we need to be environmentally conscious. You think I'm kidding. Like, that was the message I was taught. Well, I wonder what you think. Because I don't think that's actually John's point. You know, the word for lost shows up later in verse 39, and we're going to consider that next week. But Jesus says in chapter 6, verse 39, and this is the will of him who sent me, that I, Jesus, should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up on the last day. And friends, that number 12 is not coincidental. I think we see that number 12, and what are we meant to think of the 12 tribes and the 12 disciples? John's point is not that we're to fight poverty or to pursue famine relief, right? Those are all good and true as well as they are. It's that Jesus is going to lose none of those whom he has gathered. He is going to lose none of his children. For he comes to provide for his people, then gather them together as a new people under again himself, a new and better Moses, for a new and better land. I think that's the point. Jesus alone satisfies our hunger. But the question, as we're going to see even more next week, is will we want the food that Jesus has to offer? Will we want the food he has to offer? Or are we going to expect Jesus to conform to our own menu? Are we going to expect him to, well, kind of come to our kind of culinary expectations, our desires for what we want? Are we going to require him to meet those demands before we follow him? But friends, Jesus doesn't just satisfy our hunger. He alone also silences our fears. He alone silences our fears. Because what do we see? Well, the masses are fed. And then the disciples go back down to the sea, verse 16, and they start rowing back across the Sea of Galilee. Only we read in verse 17 that little note that it's dark and that Jesus is not with them. recall darkness in John, right? That's not just usually giving us like a fact. It's not just telling us what time it is or where the sun is. Darkness is often referred to in John as a kind of spiritual darkness. And it seems the disciples here, in their own way, are going to be caught in a kind of spiritual darkness, because that's what life is without Jesus. Rowing through the storms of life without Jesus, friends, that is spiritual darkness, right? That alone is despair. And it's then, when the disciples are out now in the middle of the lake, that what happens? A storm arises. So the Sea of Galilee is some 600 feet below sea level. And so winds would whip through like a wind tunnel through that sea, and storms would just quickly hit. And now they're battling waves and they're battling the wind, and their small boat is no doubt taking on water. And they can't turn back. They've rowed for too long to sort of turn around and go back to the shore. And yet they're not able to make much headway against the wind. So things look really painfully dire and grim. And friends, it's good to remember, how exactly did they get here? Because from Matthew's account, he makes more explicit what's in John's account. Jesus sent them across the lake. He's like, I'll join you. You guys go out first. Jesus sent them. He compelled them to go. So why are they in trouble? Because they pointed their boat in the direction the Lord told them. And they rowed straight into a storm. They found themselves in the middle of a storm, not because they had become disobedient, but precisely because they were obedient. It is so easy as Christians to think that the trials we face are some kind of accidents, or worse, some kind of divine punishment for something we've done. I know when I first became a Christian, this was a strong temptation of mine. I thought of God kind of like how the Greeks and Romans thought of gods. If you did well, like, he was really kind to you, maybe he paid attention to you, and if you didn't, he just smacked you up a good bit. And so if anything would happen in my life that went sideways, I would just assume like this was God getting back at me. This was God punishing me in some way. And you could be seven this morning. You may think the same thing. You could be well along in your faith. And the reality is, we can sink back into those thoughts. And yet here we're seeing that's not it at all. Right here, God's trials are not meant to punish us. They are, again, meant what? Another trial to test and refine us. The storms that God sends our way are the means by which God then reveals himself to us and grows us, because it's in the midst of the storm that, what does God do? He deepens our faith. He grows our love, strengthens our own assurance and comfort. Now, it doesn't happen immediately, because what do they see? They see a man strolling across the seas like he's out for a leisurely evening walk. Now, folks like Albert Schweitzer, if you know anything about biblical history, not important, but this guy like Albert Schweitzer and others like him, you know what, they read this and they're like, oh no, don't be mistaken, Jesus is really just walking along the shoreline. You know, what happened is, yeah, the storm hit, and then the waves and the wind, and it kind of disoriented the disciples, and they thought they were in the middle of the sea, but they really weren't. They were really right along the shore, and they just saw Jesus along the shore, and they got afraid. I mean, in my mind, like, it takes a lot of gymnastics to get to that point, right? I think I would have broken my back before I got there. The problem, of course, is they are a few miles out to sea, right? They're painfully far away from shore, and they know it. And Jesus isn't just walking along the shoreline. He is literally walking across and surfing those waves. And if he was really on the shoreline and they were right by the shore, they could be like, hey, listen, why are we battling these waves? Let's just go right onto the shore. We'll ride the storm out. Hey, Jesus, there you are. We'll come join you. That's not what they do. They see this apparition approaching them, this ancient mariner, again, strolling on the waves. And they're terrified. They're about ready to jump out of the boat before they meet this person. And what does Jesus do? He speaks to them, verse 20. It is I. Do not be afraid. He silences their fears. And we realize that these disciples were never out of Jesus' sight. Even if Jesus was out of their sight, they were never out of his sight. And so they welcome him into the boat. Because friends, when you've got Jesus in your boat, you've got nothing to fear. And the storm subsides, and no sooner do they find themselves on the other side of the shore. Friends, it is like that in the Christian life. God will lead us into trials, often to test us. He's going to often bring us again to the end of ourselves. He'll often take us into the storm, but what he never leaves us in the storm. That's what we've been singing about this morning. No, instead he comes to us and he meets us and he climbs into the boat with us and he brings us across those waters and he brings us safely to that golden shore. But Jesus is the deliverer we need, not just because he alone satisfies our hunger, not just because he alone silences our fears. It's because he alone saves us from sin. He alone saves us from sin. Because again, when is all this happening? Verse 4, it's Passover time. Passover, again, takes us back to Exodus, where God instituted that a lamb would be slain. And a meal would be eaten in haste in order to commemorate how God would lead his people in haste out of Egypt and out of their bondage of slavery and into the promised land. No other Jewish holiday compared to the Passover. So the Passover for us, that'd be like taking the 4th of July or Happy Treason Day. It'd be like taking the 4th of July and Christmas and wrapping it into one big holiday. That would be like Passover. It reminds the Jews, and it's a reminder to us that we're all in bondage. Now, of course, we're not in bondage to Egyptian slavery, but we are, in fact, in bondage to something far more deadly, far more perilous. We all are born in bondage to our own sin. And so what? A lamb has to be slain. And who has John already declared Jesus to be? Both John the author and John the Baptist. The Lamb of God, who comes to take away the sin of the world, John 1:29, and the bread that Jesus gives them. Jesus is about to teach them, chapter 6, verse 51, that this bread that he gives is his flesh. It's his body, he says, sacrificed for us. Friends, it's what we're about to celebrate in a few minutes with the Lord's Supper. This verse 11, what do we read about? When Jesus, what does he do? When he performs this miracle, he gives thanks and he distributes the bread. And that word give thanks is eucharisteo. It's just where we get our English word Eucharist, or what we often refer to as the Lord's Supper, where we, after Christ's own example, what do? We break bread as a reminder of that body, Jesus' body, his flesh that was sacrificed for us. And then we drink of the vine as a reminder of his blood spilled out for us. You see, even here, in what he's doing in this visual reenactment with the bread and happening at Passover, he is teaching us that he alone has the power to cancel the debt of our sin. He alone is the Passover lamb that can satisfy God's wrath against sin. His flesh for our flesh, right? His life for our life. And friends, that is the gospel. That is the good news that we Christians hold out and believe. Not that we have to work to win God's favor, but that Jesus has already won God's favor for us. Right? He's the one who's lived the perfect life in our place. He's the one who's died our death, the sacrificial death. Well, he's died the sinner's death that we deserve, but he's died it as a sacrifice for sinners. Jesus has forever won God's favor so that we don't have to live anxiously trying to win it. Rather, we can possess it. It is a gift that we receive when we believe upon him, when we turn from our sin and trust in him as that lamb who's come, right, to take away the Lamb of God, to take away the sins of the world. Friends, Jesus is the deliverer we need. That's what he's at pains to make clear, John is. And yet, how do we know that? Because secondly, and again, far more briefly, Jesus is divine. How do we know that Jesus is the deliverer we need? It's because, secondly, Jesus is divine. That is the unmistakable conclusion that we draw from these two miracles. For who fed God's people in the first Exodus? Well, God fed them. Remember, this manna, like heavenly donuts, glazed old fashions or something. You all know I love a donut, right? I love thinking about manna. That's not the point. Point being, Moses didn't rain the manna from heaven, right? God brought the manna from heaven. And notice now who is in the wilderness feeding God's people. Well, Jesus is. He is doing what only God can do because he himself is God. And notice Jesus is the one, verse 15, who perceives what they, the crowds, were about to do. They're about to come and take him by force. And friend, in the Bible, who's the only person who can infallibly read not only our own actions, but even our own hearts, the thoughts deep within? Friends, only God can do that. And notice it's Jesus is the one, verse 19, who's walking on the sea. And friend, in the Old Testament, who alone has the power to walk upon the seas? Right? Only God does. Job 9, verse 8. God alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. Right? There, Jesus is doing what only God can do to help show everyone that he indeed is God. And notice even how Jesus reveals himself in verse 20. As he revealed himself to his frightened disciples, he says, "It is I," right? Ego eimi, what we can also just translate more woodenly, "I am." That's a term John will use 24 different times in this gospel, right? I am the good shepherd. I am the vine. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the door of the sheep. Like all those I am statements all over John's gospel, we're beginning to get them now. And how did God reveal himself to a similarly frightened Moses back in the Exodus, right? What Bree Jones is reading to us early from Exodus 3. How did God reveal himself to a frightened Moses? Exodus 3. He revealed himself as what? As the great I am. Jesus is taking for himself the very name of God because he is God in the flesh. And that's the beautiful scene. And I think the beautiful thing about this, what happened upon those waters. Because what are the first words out of Jesus' mouth? He doesn't start barking orders like, "Why are you afraid? Stop being so afraid." He doesn't do that. What does he do? He comes to them and says, "I am is with you. I am is with you." He offers them an invitation. He offers them an invitation to embrace him before he ever gives them any comforting instructions. Because it's only then when he comes to us, God in the flesh, that we can embrace Christ, receive all his help, and are now free to fear no more. Jesus is the deliverer we need because Jesus is divine. That's what John wants us to see, which leaves us with the simple question. What are we going to do with this Jesus from John 6 this morning? Because the people clearly love him. Twice we're told it's a large crowd that's following him. After all, who doesn't love free healthcare? Who doesn't love a kind of free Meals on Wheels, right? The people are going to love it. And we know they do. They declare that he is, verse 14, the prophet after Moses, the one after Deuteronomy 18. And they want to make him king, and they want to do so by force, verse 15. And friends, that's honestly, I think, how many still follow Jesus today. They are happy to follow Jesus insofar as Jesus fills their bellies, or insofar as Jesus heals their bodies, or insofar as Jesus puts the right people into power. We're anxious for all that Jesus can do for us. And insofar as Jesus delivers on those blessings we desire, well, then guess what? Jesus gets our vote. But friends, that's not at all what it means to follow Jesus, not in the Gospels. Jesus is no politician offering handouts and trying to win our vote. True followers follow Jesus for the being that he is, not simply the blessings he provides. The only way to come to Jesus is to lay down your expectations. It is to put aside your requirements. It's to let go of the strings and follow him for who he is. Jesus came to be king. These followers, so many of them, want Jesus to be king on their terms, which is why, like Gandalf in The Hobbit, like the guy just disappears randomly. Like, where'd he go? Well, because he's not going to be king on their terms. He will be king on his own terms. At the end of the day, we follow Jesus because he's Jesus. He could never answer another prayer. He could never calm another anxious soul. He could never feed another belly. He could never again act or intervene in a gracious way in our lives. And you know what? He would still be infinitely worthy of our worship because he's Jesus. That's why. Jesus is worthy not simply because of what he does, but because of who he is. And that's what John wants us to see. Who is he? He's not some miracle worker simply performing kind of parlor tricks. That's not who the guy is. Jesus is the new and better Moses. He is the one leading a new and better rescue in the form of a new and better Exodus to a new and better promised land for his new people. That's what Jesus is about right here. John is saying that in every way, Jesus is the deliverer we need because Jesus is divine. And so, in the words of Paul Harvey, now you know the rest of the story. So what are you going to do with Jesus? Let's pray.